Don't turn around. Turn it down a little bit. Maybe that's enough. That's enough. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So we'll see how this works. Rob did a lot of work researching a system for us, and he came up with this as being maybe the best thing we could do, because enough people were, I don't know if anybody complained, but were pointing out that they couldn't hear me very well. And sometimes when I speak, my voice gets softer and softer, I guess, and I think I'm talking loud. And so I didn't really want to try to project my voice a lot. It didn't really work for me. I didn't like it so much. So we tried some kind of system. Not working?
Well, it's mushy.
It's mushy. What if we turn it down? So let's see. Is that maybe... Keep it really low. It doesn't have to...
There's nothing
coming out now.
Well, I can hear you.
Yeah. I mean, I could whisper some more. Can you hear me now? So what about now? How about now? Does that seem to be working now?
Yeah.
Now, is it mushy or is it funny or does it seem okay? Okay, well, it depends maybe where you are in the room. Okay, well,
right on top of you.
So we'll try it. Let's try it a little bit, and then maybe a few minutes we'll ask again, see how it's going. And you guys will be patient as we try to work it out. So first, a few announcements, and the first one is that. The parking lot, this lot that's right next to the entrance here, is a handicapped lot. And I've noticed a number of times people have parked there who I don't think were handicapped, but they might have been. It's just hard to know. But it happened once that someone who was in a wheelchair couldn't park there and had to park farther away, and it was a little bit awkward to come all the way over here then. And I've noticed that the handicap sign that's painted on the... symbol, which is painted on the asphalt, is almost completely worn away. So it's kind of hard actually to see this handicap sign, handicap slot. And what I was wondering is if we could have someone who could maybe volunteer, could maybe be two people, maybe Greg could be one of them. The idea is, Greg's the operational manager. And the contact with the friends is maybe, if it's okay with you, Greg, is maybe you could ask the friends if it would be okay if we touched it up to make it kind of really look like it's supposed to look.
I'll find out.
And then, so Greg will find that out. And then there's someone who will volunteer to do the work of touching it up. Yes? Thank you. It's probably just getting spray paint and masking tape and making it nice again. So you and Greg need to somehow find out it's okay with the Quakers, with the friends. And the other is this, how's it going now with the speaking system? Is this an improvement?
Yeah.
Good. Sorry? What?
Yeah,
we'll have to paint it or something. Bring more paint. Now, if we're going to use this set, it comes in a box about this size when it's all packed up, and we need to keep it somewhere. And the closet that we have here is already packed full of literature and things. We don't have any more space, and I don't feel it's really appropriate for us to leave it here in this room, like under the bench or something. So I don't know what I don't know what to do about this new equipment. But it seems to me that perhaps someone needs to take it back and forth from home and bring it every week and set it up. And so we need one more task for the Sangha to take care of. And which in some ways is, just one more task, with one more opportunity for practice for someone. Practice of generosity and patience and whatever. And so the question is, Because is there someone who can do this essential work if we're going to have a speaking system? Because if we don't have someone who can do it, then it won't happen. And I'm not going to speak louder. Yes? It's virtually out of the question. For all practical purposes, it is. I guess it's not so important. I guess we do it out.
Maybe someone could take the literature out of the.
It's very kind of you, and I think it's a very nice, it's a fantastic service. I think Rob has done setting it up, and you do, and many people will, I'm sure, benefit from hearing the Dharma now. What? Well, that's the other question. And there's two primary ways to pay for it. One is for us to put a third basket out, and everybody who feels inspired to help pay for the system contribute to that basket. And that somehow seems the cleanest. But the other way, or if that is not enough, is to go to our brave steering committee who manages our funds. And the steering committee could decide whether they could, out of the funds, pay for the system. And the funds would be the kind of the extra money that comes from the rent dana, is like we get actually a little bit more than actually pays for rent. And it gets used for other expenses. And this could be another expense. It just kind of makes sense. So those are the two systems. Now, I don't know how.
How much is it?
How much is it?
$220.
$220.
We have enough money in the rent dana?
We do. We could do.
If everybody contributed $2 tonight.
Should we do that?
Yeah.
And it'd be nice. I think somehow it feels kind of, I don't know why I feel it. It feels nice just to come from all of us. It really feels like this thing comes from all of us. So those of us who really appreciate it. Maybe someone could find another basket. Is there an extra one out there? Does anybody know if in the closet? Could someone maybe go out and get it? Maybe now.
Maybe put it out for a couple of weeks.
And good. I thought I had three announcements, but then that's all I had. Any other announcements? Oh yes, the other announcement I had is next week Howie Cohn is going to come and give a talk here. And Howie Cohn is a wonderful teacher who teaches in San Francisco and up in Sausalito and at Spirit Rock, one of, you know, part of the Spirit Rock teaching collective that I'm part of. And he's been here a few times before. And what we need is someone to host him when he's here, who receives him and makes sure he feels welcome and knows what to do. And it would be nice if it was someone who knew him, who recognized him when he came through the door. Okay, there's the basket. So why don't you put it between the other two baskets? So the middle basket is for the speaker system.
Yeah.
Yes?
Would it be possible to pass it now?
Let's not. It reminds me too much of something else. It's probably a great idea, but my associations.
Your associations are
passing the basket in church. Maybe it's, you know, maybe we're a church and it's exactly the same thing we do. No. So is there someone who could be his host, who could receive him and do that next week? Who knows him? Or he doesn't know him. Great, thank you. Okay. Okay. Some of you might be waiting for the Dharma to happen. But this is the Dharma. Greg.
The woman who handles the, takes care of the meals for the homeless who stay here during the month of December, has put up a sign-up sheet out here in the doors in the lobby, and she indicated that if people from this community wanted to help in some way, they could sign up out there. They could look it up. There's information out there. Her name and number is on that sign-up list. And if people didn't want to prepare a meal or bring food, she suggested that if people were interested, they could make a contribution to the Friends meeting. And if you wanted to, you could make a check out to follow up the Friends meeting and would just find some way to collect it. And that would be considered a charitable donation, so it could be a tax deduction.
Fantastic, thank you. What we talked about last week is to do the same thing we did last year, which is Sarah Todd, who's not here tonight, will coordinate our involvement. But certainly anybody who wants to should also sign up that's a place to sign up. And Sarah next week will also talk more about it. Anything else before we do a different kind of... So this is the third full day of a 16-day residential retreat that I'm teaching with others up in San Rafael. And I left there to come down here and give our sitting today. And it always feels very special to be at such a retreat. But the first evening of the retreat, Friday evening, we all gathered, and there were about 55 people who were there. And this is an old students' retreat, people who've done a fair amount of practice before. And as we started off the evening, the first opening, I looked around the room and saw all these people sitting in meditation posture, all quite still and erect and poised, composed. And I felt this tremendous happiness, in a sense, and inspiration. And what I felt in seeing that was, I saw a flood of lineage going back historically to Southeast Asia and to India and to the Buddha, of people who practiced meditation and have practiced it and kept the kind of the flame alive for 2,500 years. And it was inspiring to see all these people, the silence and the intensity. And it's quite rare, actually, to have that. It's quite rare to have what we have here in Palo Alto Monday nights, I feel. And it occurred to me that at that time, I was reminded that until about 60 years ago, the only people who did this thing, who would go on retreat, who would sit this way silently together, had this the composure, the stillness, the presence that was in that room Friday night, and was the monastic community, the community of monks and nuns. And that the meditation practice that we teach, that we practice, was almost the sole domain, kind of the monastic community had a monopoly on it. Lay people in Southeast Asia basically didn't meditate at all. As Buddhists, they were involved in many other forms of practices. One of them was making merit, and they would make offerings to the monks and the nuns and support the monks and the nuns so they could practice. And there was a kind of a great split between the laity and the monastics practice-wise. And there was a kind of aura then of mystique, of mystery around the monks and the nuns, because they did this mysterious thing called meditation, and who knows, psychic powers and strange, they read your thoughts, and who knows what happens in that strange world. And so 60 years ago, in Burma, there was a concentrated attempt to begin offering mindfulness meditation to lay people. And that kind of snowballed. And especially after World War II, it really picked up speed and created many, many lay meditation centers all over Burma. And now there's like 300-400 of them, or maybe more. And I was at one where spring break, there was a week or 10 days where 5,000 people came to this monastery I was at to meditate. And it was just, can you imagine the amount of people? They're all sitting meditating quietly. And one of the most powerful sights of my life, external sights, was there in that meditation monastery, of seeing the women's meditation hall. And there were 500 women, because it was in Burma, it's hot, and so they had this huge, most of those two walls were just mostly just completely open to the outside. And there was 500 women, row after row, neat row, sitting there with great dignity, all meditating in silence. It was like this powerhouse of spirituality to see these 500 women sitting there. And I just, I've never seen anything like that before. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see that in America, that kind of intensity, that kind of involvement. And it's so then from Burma, then it spread first to Sri Lanka in the 50s. And then in the 60s, the offering of meditation practice to the laity then went to Thailand from Burma also. And now there's quite a popular movement in Southeast Asia of lay people practicing meditation. And then many of the early Westerners who practiced meditation in Asia, in Southeast Asia, they practiced with either directly or with students of the Burmese who were trying to perpetuate this revolution of bringing meditation to the laity. And so as you bring the meditation to the laity, as you bring the central practice of Buddhism to the lay people, and it's no longer has the monastics no longer have a monopoly on it, as a result, the central position that the monastic community had in Theravadan Buddhism also began to be to decrease in some way. Because until that point, they were the sole carriers of the inner spiritual, deep spiritual tradition. And so they were highly honored, justifiably so, and protected and supported and everything. But they were the sole carriers of that. But once you started offering to lay people, and lay people started to become enlightened, and they said become enlightened and stayed lay people, didn't become monastics, then no longer did the monks have it as their sole monopoly, in a sense. So some of our teachers, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and others, practiced in India, practiced in Burma, as lay people, in a system where you didn't have to become a monk. So then when they came back to America, they didn't have this idea you had to be a monk to practice. And so, whereas in Southeast Asia, the monastic community was still somewhat central, even not as central as it was maybe 60 years ago, it became even less central here in America. And now we have this whole movement of insight meditation that we're part of, where it's basically a lay movement. The monastic community is certainly not central, at least in most people's eyes. Some people would say it is, but practically, pragmatically, it looks like it's kind of way out in the periphery, and we have some contact with it, and we're inspired by it, and some of us. But it's here in America especially, it's for many people, it's invisible, the monastic community. It's almost entirely a lay practitioners. And as we do that, what we've done is we've lost the central carrier of the tradition, because the monks didn't just carry the meditation practice, they carried much more of the Buddhist tradition of Theravadan Buddhism. And when we dropped the monastic forms, we lost the carrier, the container, the vehicle for a lot of other things besides just meditation. We kind of pulled meditation out. And part of all this history is that the people who are off, there's a strong feeling in Buddhism, especially in Theravadan Buddhism, that what really counts is not doctrine, not belief, but what really counts is practice. So they make a distinction between, or scholars make the distinction, between religious traditions that focus more on orthodoxy and traditions that focus more on orthopraxy. And orthodoxy is doctrine, orthodox doctrine. Orthopraxy is orthodox practice. And the Theravada tradition puts a lot more stress on orthopraxy, on particular forms of practice, and maybe particular forms of realizations you get from the practice. And they don't care that much about teaching. So when Westerners came to practice in Southeast Asia, their teachers would offer freely this meditation practice. Now, this is a really great practice. Try it out. You don't have to become a Buddhist. You don't have to believe these teachings. It's just a good idea to do this stuff, to pay attention. So come and try it out. And then people would try it out, and some people were tremendously inspired by it and transformed by it. And they said, this is really great. I would like to offer this to my friends. When you discover something you really love, so often there's a natural desire to share it with others. So again, not only was the monastic form in some ways dropped, but a lot of the teachings were dropped, because what's important was the practice, right, and not necessarily the teachings. Then the third thing, part of the Theravada teaching, part of the tradition, is freedom. It's a practice of freedom. And it's freedom from maybe many things, but one of them is freedom from identification of all sorts. Identifying anything as a self. Forming any clinging to certain kinds of identities. And one way you can form an identity, cling to an identity, is to identify with a religious tradition. You identify that you're a Buddhist, or you're a Theravada Buddhist, or whatever. And that's a no-no. Because then you're not free. So it's a strange tradition which deconstructs itself in some ways. It says, you know, you don't form any identifications, even to this tradition. But if you do that, and then you don't take the monastic tradition with you, you don't take the doctrine as much with you, and you don't take identity so much with you, you come to America, and what do we have? A lot of people, I think, who come to this group here Monday night don't have a clue that we come from a Southeast Asian tradition. Maybe you don't. I don't know. I don't mention it that often. And I almost never use a T word. Theravada. Theravada is the name of the Buddhist tradition that exists in Southeast Asia. And Thera means elder, and Vada means the way. It's the way of the elders, which is a beautiful and beautiful name, especially nowadays. In the last 10 years, elderhood is becoming respected again. The way of the elders. So what we find here in America is a tradition what was imported to America was very much a meditation practice. And it's the only form of Buddhism that was imported to America that didn't come with its full baggage. Zen came, you know, Suzuki Roshi came, and Sasaki Roshi came, and Meizumi Roshi came as priests, as monks. And they came, especially when you're a priest and a monk, you carry everything with you. All the paraphernalia. And when you're a Zen priest, there's a lot of paraphernalia. And you set up temples and gongs and bells and forms and rituals and, you know, the whole stuff, and robes and whisks and staffs and, you know, altars and incense and wisdom water and ceremonies and initiations and head shavings. And you take all this with you. And Tibetans also, when they came to this country, they brought, you know, the full show with them. And Trungpa tried with his Shambhala system to drop some of it, but still, he had just kind of two parallel things going, right? And he brought the whole show, Tibetan show. And that's really Catholic. Someone pointed out that the Tibetan Buddhists are more like the Catholics. The Zen people are more like the Protestants, and maybe more like the, or maybe like Unitarians. I don't know. No, maybe I don't know. And then the Zen people are more like the Protestants, and the Protestant people are more like the Unitarians. So I don't know if that's fair or even nice to say in either direction. But So we didn't bring all this. What we brought was really a really the heart of it was a meditation practice, and then, and not only just a meditation practice, but also the system of retreats, of offering this meditation practice in an intense setting of being on retreat. So when this practice came to America, when it really took hold, Vipassana, mindfulness practice, really took hold. Well, people first started teaching it in America. Does history interest you enough?
Mm-hmm.
Dates. it's really the first time apparently the practice has really started to kind of being taught by people who really knew it, had been trained in Asia, was around 1971 or 72. People like Sujata. Sujata used to teach in San Jose at some point. And Ruth Dennison, and a guy named Robert Hover. And then in 1974, Chogyam Trungpa, who was the rascal of Tibetan Buddhism and did a lot to introduce Buddhism to the West, he started this college in Boulder called Naropa College, and they had a summer course where it was kind of like a Dharma festival. And he wanted all the traditions represented there. And he met Jack Kornfield at a party in Boston. And Jack Kornfield had just disrobed as a monk and was back in his country. And he found out that Jack had been a monk, practiced meditation in Asia for many years, and asked him to come and teach at a summer class. And Jack said, no, he couldn't do that. He wasn't qualified. And then Trungpa said something like, oh, then certainly you are. And so Jack went to Naropa, and Ramdas, who many of you know, was also went to teach a class. And he had, you know, his huge class on Indian spirituality, or whatever. And since it was a college, he had sections. And so he invited different people to lead the sections. And he knew Joseph Goldstein. Actually, I think he was from India, but the connection happened that they happened to meet in a coffee shop in Berkeley. And Ramdas said, hey, would you come and help teach a section? So he went and teach a section. So both Jack and Joseph were teaching in that summer program. And they knew each other from before, but that's when they really became, they hooked up and started to team up as partners. And then they started teaching retreats around the country. And those retreats then, where they were offering the practice the way they learned it in Asia, which you do it intensely if you do it. You don't just kind of do it, you know, before you go to work for half an hour, but you kind of throw yourself into it fully. You submerge yourself in the world of meditation. If you go to Burma to meditation monasteries there, you go there to meditate from the schedule. This is from 3 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. And you take, you know, a little bit break for meals. You get 2 meals. And maybe you have a Dharma talk, and maybe you have an interview with a teacher, but it's quite intense. So that's what they offered, was they offered a meditation practice, and they offered this intense container for the meditation practice. And they did it for years. And then slowly, as there were more and more Americans, Western students who practiced with them, and the kind of the group of people interested in Vipassana grew, people started wanting then naturally to begin integrating that practice, that retreat practice, into their daily life. And there was increasing an attempt to try to bring the practice into daily life. But in doing that, in a sense, they were inventing anew a whole tradition from the core of a single meditation practice. So that's a lot different than starting with bringing a whole tradition and then this new culture coping with that, and bringing just one practice and then letting something grow around it. So we're in the process of doing that. And as we do that, we're in an ambivalent relationship with the mother source of this practice, the thousand-year-old tradition that carried this practice in Southeast Asia, which is a Theravada tradition. So I wrote that article in The Inquiring Mind that hopefully some of you maybe read it. I talked about some of these issues. One of the things that's being met in as Buddhism comes to America is American individualism. And American individualism, it means many different things for different people. So, but maybe simplistically it means what's in it for me? So a lot of Westerners come to Buddhism or come to the practice with a question, what's in it for me? And they want something from it. And what do you want from this practice? And the challenge of American individualism against Buddhism, I think, is a very, very delicate challenge. Because many of us are blind to how strong our Western cultural values are ingrained in us. We're blind, I think, to even people who know really well what it is, I think even blind to aspects of this thing called individualism, which maybe you have to read Tocqueville to really maybe begin getting a sense of it. But when you have a tradition which is so bare bones as this one we have, where you don't have to become a Buddhist, you don't have to become a monk or a nun, you don't have to believe anything here, you don't have to make a big commitment, you don't have to become a member, you don't have to pay anything. I mean, it's a donation system, right? So you don't have to make this commitment, at least paying for something. So not very little is required from people. Except to come and do the practice. So if nothing's required of you, then maybe it's hard to see clearly what's in it for me attitude. If there's a lot of things required of you, suddenly you say, wait a minute, hey, This is not what I bargained for. This is not what I want to do. I feel challenged. Why am I bowing now? Or why am I having to put on a robe? Or why am I having to offer incense now? Or why am I having to do this and that? And so, but here there's a very little questioning of why do I have to do anything different than what I'm doing? So you all come in your normal clothes. And some of you even stayed home tonight to watch the 49ers. because you do whatever you want. And very different from, Ajahn Tat was. Ajahn Tat was this great forest monk in Thailand, who died in his 90s. He died last year. And in his autobiography, he writes of when he was a novice or a young monk in his late teens, I think. He was a student of the great meditation master Ajahn Mun, who roamed around as a wandering monk. The beginning part of this century in northeastern Thailand. And he received meditation instruction from his teacher. And then he went off for a year to practice those instructions by himself in some little forest place. And he came to a place in his meditation where he had a tremendous amount of pliancy of mind, delight, joy, and lots of light. And he didn't know how to proceed in his meditation practice once he had all these experiences. So he went around and asked the different meditation teachers he could find around him, and he wasn't satisfied with any of their answers. Some of them said something like, go with the light. And some of them said, no, don't go with the light, go back into your body. And he didn't feel satisfied with any of them. So he decided to go find his teacher, Ajahn Mun. But his teacher was a wandering monk. So where do you find a wandering monk? So he heard he had gone up north to Laos. So he trudged through the... This is back when they had jungles still, and terrible jungles, deep, dense jungles in that part of the world, and they had tigers. And if you believe the stories of the autobiographies of these people, the biographies, they also had demons in the forest. But they had man-eating tigers. They had a lot of dangers. And so he trudged up to Laos looking for his teacher. And he came to Laos and he asked around. And they said, no, my teacher has gone to... I tell you, the guy, he's gone to northern Thailand. So he went to northern Thailand. And he's gone back down to northeastern Thailand. Back. So he'd go down... For 2 years, he wandered around looking for his teacher. Can you imagine the I mean, he wasn't just like, I just dropped by, if the 49ers aren't playing. You know, it's like, you know, this was the thing he was going to do with his life. He was really serious, and he used to ask his questions, ask one question. And he went to Burma, and he finally found his teacher after 2 years. And he asked this question, what should I do? Should I go with the light, or should I go back into my body, or what should I do with what's happening? And his teacher said something like, just be where you're at. Which maybe was the wisest answer. Just be with what's happening with you right now. Don't go after anything. But the meeting of American individualism and American culture, the American part of what we're doing, the American is it doesn't get challenged very much directly when we kind of can be the way we are here. And I think it's very easy to come and just to say, you know, come here because, you know, what's in it for me kind of attitude. But I think that's fine to have that attitude. And that's part of the way we offer this practice. We offer it to anybody who's interested in it, because we have so much love and appreciation of the power of this practice. We want to offer it to anybody who finds it valuable, whether it helps you just get a little bit calm. And maybe some people, all they want is they want to continue their life, the normal life, work and have family and watch the 49ers and do everything. But they just want to be able to do a little bit more calm. So they find meditating every day brings a little bit more calm and kind of lubricates their day. That's all they want. And if whether they work for the Pentagon or whether they work for the Red Cross, it doesn't really matter for them. They just want to get a little bit of calm. Other people, and I think it's really marvelous to offer that to people. Other people have much more, and there's a whole spectrum then of interests, from something like that to real powerful spiritual questing. The real entering into a deep question of, for example, who am I? And trying to understand, who am I really? One of the great spiritual questions of all time. Who am I? After I did my first retreat in Southeast Asia for 10 weeks, I touched something in the stillness, the great concentration and stillness of that retreat that I'd never touched before in my life. And the only way I can characterize it was a sense of self. And I didn't feel like it was, you know, bad or whatever, like sometimes maybe a Buddhist might think. Just, it was just something that I never touched before. And after I left that retreat, it became essential for me to go touch that place again. I had no choice. And the longer the opportunities to go back to Asia were delayed, the more, in a sense, depressed I got, despairing I got. It was kind of almost like a dark night of the soul. It wasn't like any choice, it was organic almost. It was like, and I've been practicing for years in the tradition that said, don't strive. Don't go after anything. Don't look for anything. Don't go after distant, dusty lands. You know, just find your home right here. But sometimes if you do that really thoroughly, you'll find that right here is motivated by something. And I was powerfully motivated. And so finally I was able to, I applied to go to Burma. And it's difficult to get into Burma, and I had to wait 9 months to get my visa. And after waiting for 4 months in this country to get the visa, I said, I just can't wait here anymore. I have to go. And so I went to Southeast Asia. I went to Thailand and told the embassy in Washington to transfer my application to Bangkok. And then I waited there for another 5 months. And I did a lot of practice during that time. It wasn't just waiting in Bangkok, but I practiced, but I was really wanting to go to Burma. That's where I'd set my heart to go and practice. And finally, when I finally got my visa from the Burmese consulate, embassy in Bangkok, I left my passport the day before and went and picked it up, and there was the Burmese visa on it. And it's very hard to get a long visa for Burma back then. You can get 1 week visas, and that was it. But it's the only country in the world that has a category called meditation visa, because they really like people to meditate. So I had this little, it didn't say meditation visa, but that's what it was. And I kind of skipped out of the embassy. And and I'm a little embarrassing to say what I sang, but I kind of skipped down the street in Bangkok singing, "You can get it if you really want. Get it if you really want. But you have to try, try and try." Something like that, right? That's how the song goes? And because that's, I had to touch that place again. I had no choice but to do that. And I went there without any idea of how long I was going. I said at the time to a friend that I'd come to the end of the line, and I was just going to go there and we'll see. This is mostly not what I want to talk about tonight. Mostly what I wanted to talk about tonight was the three refuges, taking refuge. So I won't tonight, because I'm running out of time. If we were part of the forest monastic tradition, and you were all monks and nuns, or even if you were lay people coming to listen to the teacher, the monk kind of speaking, he wouldn't be concerned about not 4 minutes to nine. And he just, he's getting warmed up now. and the real powerful Dharma, if you just let me keep going, that's when it's going to happen. But, you have to get up and go to work tomorrow morning, and you're getting restless. And if you're restless and getting impatient, and that's more important than the Dharma, and who's this guy anyway, talking away? And I probably know better. Or whatever, we do in our culture, right? But the sense of faith or the sense of challenge, what would it be like to sit here all night and listen to Dharma talk until dawn? Would you be challenged?
Sure.
And what would be challenged? I've gone too far. They called me on my bluff. So I'll say a few more words and try to ignore that one. And it would be very interesting to do someday. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should do it someday.
About 9:30.
I would like actually to stop because being away on retreat, I don't have much time to be with my wife. And I feel like I need the few minutes that I can get with her tonight before she goes to sleep are really precious, and I need to take care of my family. So I would like to end for that, partly for that reason, and partly because I'm also helping to run this retreat, and I also need some sleep in order to really be present fully there. So that's my reasons. But what I was going to talk about the three refuges, because the three refuges are, in some ways, one way of understanding them is understanding the context of this practice in a context which is larger than our own individual life. And to understand taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is to understand that to practice is to be in a larger context. And I was going to talk about a larger context as a way of maybe not so much challenging American individualism. I don't think it's possible to challenge it and to get rid of it, even though it's so painful for us. I think much of American individualism is so painful because one of the consequences of it is it isolates us. But I think what has to happen, is my guess, is that we have to not get rid of it, but in some sense go into it, find maybe what's important there, what's really precious there, and go beyond it or transcend it. And one way of talking about the triple refuge, the triple refuge is beginning to understand how we start with ourselves and honor ourselves and then find something that's larger than ourselves. So I'll save that for another week, talk about the triple refuge. And this thing about individualism, we, for some reason in the West, have chosen to translate. You know, it says, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Buddham is Buddha. Saranam means refuge. And we translate Gacchami in the West as to take. I take refuge in the Buddha. It literally, Gacchami means to go for. I go for means like to walk for, to go for refuge. Now, why do the Americans say take? Why do you think we end up saying, I take refuge? You have to go for refuge. It's something that you don't take and make your own, but it's something you go into. It's something that it involves you doing something, not something just you take. And then the last little thing, I can't resist, is part of taking refuge or going for refuge is to offer refuge to others. And I don't believe you can fully take refuge or go for refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha unless at the same time you also offer refuge to others, to your fellow community, practitioners, and to the world. So maybe some of that is what we'll talk about in maybe in 2 weeks. If it's, and next week it's Hawi, and maybe in 2 weeks I'll tell you a little bit more about the retreat. Thank you all.